From KCRW and KCRW.com, this is Left, Right, and Center.
You like potato?
And you like potato?
You like tomato?
And you like tomato?
Potato?
Potato?
Tomato?
Tomato?
Let's call a potato.
At long last, Republicans have a health care plan. Liberals worry it will strip millions of their health insurance, while some conservatives think it doesn't go far enough. Welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. I'm Josh Barrow, senior editor at Business Insider. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Joan Walsh, national affairs correspondent at The Nation magazine and MSNBC analyst. Our special guest is Megan McArdle of Bloomberg View. Welcome, everybody. On Monday, House Republicans released their plan to revise Obamacare. It's not exactly repeal and replacement, but it would make a lot of changes. It would wind down the Medicaid expansion over a period of years, and while it would keep tax credits that help people buy insurance, it would change who gets how much. The plan repeals almost all the taxes imposed by the Affordable Care Act, so anti-tax activists on the right seem to like the bill a lot, but not that many other people do. Liberals and some Republican moderates are concerned that the bill would cause millions of Americans to lose health insurance coverage, and that cuts to Medicaid would cause crises in the budgets of states because states run Medicaid jointly with the federal government. Meanwhile, a lot of conservatives in Congress and outside it think the bill doesn't go far enough. Rand Paul calls it Obamacare light. And health policy experts on the right worry the bill does nothing to fix what they see as problems in the healthcare market that were either created or not fixed by Obamacare. Megan, I know you've been critical of Obamacare, and yet you wrote this week that the House proposal would be worse than Obamacare. Why?
It would. And the weird thing is that it's not just that it would be worse for the market than Obamacare. It would actually be worse than for Republicans than Obamacare. So I'm a little puzzled as to how this has all come about. So basically, the kind of fundamental problem with Obamacare, aside from budget problems and so forth, but the really big glaring thing that is broken with Obamacare is that they passed this structure that basically has something called guaranteed issue, which is that they have to sell policies, and community rating, which is they have to sell policies at the price they sell to everyone. So they can't be like, sure, I will cover you, cancer patient, $1 million a month. And because of those two things, what we know about those two things is that if you enact them, the market does what's called the death spiral, where basically no one buys insurance until they're sick, and then there's no insurance market. And so that's why they had the mandate. The mandate's hugely unpopular, but guaranteed issue community rating are very popular, and also they can't be touched because Democrats are going to obstruct anything Republicans do. The ghost of FDR could walk across the Potomac and tell them to vote for it, and they still wouldn't. So because of that, they're using this streamlined budget process called reconciliation. That's why, for example, they've touched all the tax stuff. All of that can be done through reconciliation, but they can't touch those regulations. And so they kind of try to play around with it. They've got this structure where instead of having a mandate, which they do repeal, they've got this, if you keep continuous coverage, you can buy at the community rating price. If you don't, there's a 30% premium penalty you have to pay for a year. Well, that's actually
so
worse
that's basically
than Obamacare.
If you drop coverage and then you come back to it, you pay a penalty for getting back into the market.
Yeah, for the next year, your premiums are 30% higher. The problem with that is that that is actually worse in terms of destabilizing the individual market. And you know, what we've been seeing is insurers have been pulling out, premiums have been going up, and there's real worry that in a year or so, there are going to be large swaths of the insurance market where it won't be possible to buy insurance at all, particularly in rural counties. So what this does is it actually, even more than the mandate, which is not strong enough, it's far too weak to do its job. This just incentivizes people to stay out until they get sick and then pay the 30% premium for a year. And worse, it actually, you know, if you have abnormally high healthcare costs and you're coming back in, of course you're going to pay the 30% premium. On the other hand, if you're healthy, you're just going to be like, you know what, I can't afford this. And so it actually makes all of the problems in the individual market worse, is very likely to collapse it. And leave Republicans, because they're the last people who tinkered with it, actually more being blamed for, rather than some of the problems with Obamacare, which they will definitely get blamed for, they're going to be blamed for all of the problems with both Obamacare and their new plan. Now, the Medicaid stuff, that's a different argument. I tend to be much more favorable to that than I would suspect, say, Joan would be. But because of that individual market component, that's sort of a deadly thing for both Americans who need to be able to buy health insurance on an individual market that will no longer exist, and for Republicans who are going to be responsible for it. It's entirely unclear why that they have decided to go forward with this.
The thing about what Megan just described and this sort of technical issue of, well, if you change these rules around what happens if you don't carry insurance, what will that do to the market? Will it cause premiums to go way up? Will it cause a lot of people to lose coverage? This is an empirical question. And when, you know, ordinarily you'd have hearings on the bill, you'd bring in experts. I hear different things from people. I hear from a lot of people what Megan says, that this would cause a lot of people to drop coverage. I hear from some other people that this provision might work about as well as the individual mandate. But it sort of feels like something that Republicans should have been discussing in detail for the last 7 years as they prepared for this moment to come in and replace the law. And it also feels like something they should be discussing now. But instead, what you have is they did not have any hearings with testimony on this law. They introduced the bill and are trying to get it to the House floor as fast as possible. And they don't have an analysis from the Congressional Budget Office that estimates these things, like how many people would have coverage, what the premiums would be, what the bill would cost. And Rich, I guess my question is, why are Republicans doing this? What end does it serve to sort of jump in and try to get everyone on board with this policy when they literally don't even know what it would do?
Well, I think there are a couple things. One, they really imagined they were going to repeal Obamacare the first day, because they had already passed a repeal bill last year. They thought they could just pick up that bill, slam it through, and they'd have a major accomplishment right off the bat. But then you have Donald Trump, rightly in my view, saying, well, don't do that, because you're going to be leaving a lot of people in the lurch, and we need to know what we're replacing it with. So instantly it becomes more complicated. But this is the first thing on the schedule. So it's still the first thing they want to do. And two, Paul Ryan believes correctly that every day that passes, you lose a little momentum. Your political capital's depleted, so you have to move as quickly as possible. So you have this process that is extremely rushed, that's kind of indefensible on the merits, and is going to get worse before it gets better. And we'll end up basically replicating every single complaint that Republicans had about how Democrats passed Obamacare in the first place. Now, you are going to get a CBO score. You know, they've done some of the committee work this week without a CBO score, but you will get it next week, and it will be a body blow, because whether it's right or not, it's going to generate headlines about 10, 15 million, whatever the number is, losing their health insurance under this plan. And one of the key political supports, and I imagine we're going to talk about the sheer politics later, under this bill is the support of Donald Trump. And if he remains committed to it, I think it gets over the hill in the House. But the question is, does he remain committed to it? And the moment of maximum peril, or at least one of them, will be next week when that CBO score comes out.
I completely agree with Rich. I mean, Donald Trump has been kind of all over the place in terms of supporting this bill. He came out and described it as our wonderful bill the first day, or the second day. The next day, he was going to be doing a barnstorming tour, and he was going to go straight to Kentucky and, you know, scare Rand Paul, one of the Senate opponents. And then the next morning, it was Pence going there, which doesn't scare anyone, I don't imagine. And you know, he doesn't, no one's calling it Trump care. He doesn't want it to be Trump care yet. And he's also playing another very strange role. He's not doing the public selling as much, but he's doing the private selling. And it sounds like, from multiple, you know, good reporters, that he's making promises to conservatives that he's going to, you know, that they'll compromise and that they will budge on, they'll make the, Medicaid reduction happen in 2018, 2019, not 2020. And Paul Ryan is tearing his hair out because he knows that a bill like that can't get past moderates in the Senate. Again, lots of things can happen that make the House bend over, but getting to the Senate with it.
If I could just address that, and this goes to Megan's points. This bill is incoherent because the House kind of compromised with itself behind closed doors with an eye to what the Senate parliamentarian would permit ultimately to pass in the Senate without a filibuster. And that's one of the reasons you have the regulations that are really at the heart of Obamacare preserved in this bill, because I don't think they can get them through the Senate process. I believe they would have been much better just starting from a blank piece of paper, so to speak, writing a completely coherent, like, Paul Ryan healthcare bill, not caring what can get through the Senate, because the Senate's going to change it anyway. So you start in a place that at least is intellectually defensible and doesn't get criticized by absolutely everyone, and you're going to get a better start to the process, no matter where it ends up eventually in the Senate and various compromises, if you do it that way. And they didn't.
I think Rich is absolutely right, is that, you know, what I said, like what I've been saying in my columns is, look, do a comprehensive bill. If you have to trim it, but like put up something that is coherent rather than this kind of weird stage. They're supposed to be phase two where they do all this regulatory stuff, which, by the way, counts on Trump to have the administrative competence to actually get all this regulatory stuff done, and has to go through the whole public comment process. And then there's phase three where they do some bill that can go through the Senate. Well, you know, if you can't get the bill through the Senate now, you're probably not going to get it through the Senate later. I don't think Democrats are going to help you after you got Obamacare.
But I see two reasons why this bill is incoherent. I think one is what you've described, that the bill has been designed around accommodating Senate procedure rather than being designed around what an ideal policy is. But I think the other reason is that Republicans have been for years going around the country making incoherent complaints and incoherent promises on health care. In one breath, they will say that the problem with Obamacare is that deductibles are too high and copayments are too high and people have this coverage that doesn't really amount for coverage because it doesn't pay for the care that they actually need to go out and get. And then in the next breath, they'll say that insurance is too expensive and insurance should really be insurance for unexpected costs and not covering routine care, and that if we make insurance something that protects people against catastrophic costs, then we can bring the premiums down and make it something that's affordable to people. And those two complaints are directly in tension with each other. Do you want the insurance to be more generous or do you want it to be less generous? And I think the answer is Republicans don't fundamentally have a view on that, or some of them do, but right. As a party, it does not have a view. And when you put this bill together, you're going to have to come down on one side or the other of that. And when you do, you're going to upset a lot of people. And I think the party just like they hadn't even thought through that contradiction.
Yeah, I mean, it's a classic case. It's just it's easier being in opposition and lodging every possible complaint about a law. And then it's different when you're in power and you have to make choices. And another reason they're kind of in an incoherent place is there's not even agreement on whether there should be a replacement. And Republicans, a number of them, who are saying, well, let's just repeal first and then we'll you know, carefully deliberate on what the replace is going to be. They don't want to replace. So they're all these factions in the party are adding to the difficulty of what inherently is an extremely difficult project.
Joan, what is there for Democrats to do here besides sort of sit back and
watch?
Yeah,
and smile. Not much. I don't think the Democrats are going to get involved in this at all, except to talk about the politics of it. I think they want to drive home the fact that if you set out to hurt Donald Trump's core voters intentionally, you would design a bill like this. The people who are really going to get hurt are red state folks, are sicker folks, are older folks, are folks that may not even know that they're on, quote, Obamacare, but they are happy with the care that they're getting, and it's going to be taken away from them. So I think Democrats are just watching the show at this point.
I think there's a long tradition of saying completely wildly incompatible things on healthcare, because the fact is that what voters want is something wildly compatible. They don't want insurance at all. What they want is for someone to give them first dollar coverage. They want no restrictions on the treatments they can get. They want to have lovely American style facilities instead of mass wards like you get in the NHS. They don't want any delay
in
seeking
United
their
Kingdom.
Treatment. In the United Kingdom. They don't want any delay in getting their treatments. They do not want to have to pay higher taxes. They think their premiums should cost roughly what their cell phone bill does, and the only people who should have to pay for it are kind of certified rich people, which is defined as people who make about twice as much as whoever is speaking thinks. These things are mathematically impossible. And they come up with rationales, but none of them make any sense, because fundamentally what people want is something impossible. And right up until the moment when they get power, politicians love to tell them that they can have it. And I think part of the problem is, right, Democrats did it. They got in and didn't deliver what they promised. And now Republicans have spent the last 8 years not coming up with a meaningful plan and telling voters that they were, you know, this is like Trump's healthcare policy, well, right? It's going to be awesome. That was basically his policy position.
But Democrats went through that compromising process.
Right.
They
right.
made it into an actual bill that didn't please everybody in their constituency groups and frankly displeased a lot of members of the public, because what they found is that when you built a bill that tried to limit the amount of public expenditure so that you could do it in a way that didn't increase deficits over a 10-year period, that the benefits had to be skimpy in certain ways.
Right.
A lot of people did get these plans that had high deductibles that they don't like, and in a lot of cases, the subsidies are less generous than people wanted to pay their premiums. And a lot of people were upset about it. But in the end, I mean, and there was overselling. I mean, if you like your plan, you can keep it, right. was not true. And Barack Obama said that over and over because Bill Clinton got in trouble for not making that promise right. 15 years earlier. But I think, you know, the Democrats got to the point where the rubber met the road and they had to decide which promises they were going to keep and which groups they were going to please. And they made the tough compromises and they paid a big political price for
right.
it.
Remember what point we're at now, right? We're in March of 2009, if you compare the processes. In March of 2009, it was all like, it's going to be fabulous and it's going to cost less and $2,500 off the family premiums, right? It was like late in 2009 when we finally found out that it wasn't going to be that awesome. And then it was you know, 2013 when we... Now, let me be fair here, right? Democrats had done a lot more policy legwork than Republicans
exactly.
have done, right? They, but that does not mean, because I remember going through this process, even people, and even now, people who were extremely well-read on the subject, but not actually kind of healthcare wonks, had wildly overblown, after it passed, wildly overblown ideas about what was going to happen from this bill, because that's how you get a healthcare bill passed. There is no other way. If you tell people what you're going to do, they will be like, no, do not do that. Give me the free imaginary thing I want.
I need to take a quick break, but let us know what you think about the Republican healthcare plan on our Facebook page or message us on Twitter. That's at LRCKCRW. Up ahead, can this thing actually pass? You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand from KCRW's smartphone apps, now for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. And share your thoughts on today's show at kcrw.com/LRC.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow of Business Insider and MSNBC. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Joan Walsh of The Nation magazine. And Megan McArdle of Bloomberg View is also with us. So as I watched the rollout of this healthcare plan this week, and I looked at the reactions from Republicans in the center and on the right, I'm finding it hard to imagine how they come together and pass something. It just feels like there are too many objections from the right and too many objections from the center, and trying to please one group involves displeasing the other. We've seen that conservative Republicans in the House are willing to buck leadership and knock down their very high priorities. Donald Trump seems tepid in his engagement so far. In fact, CNN reported that he told conservative leaders that he has a plan B already for if the plan doesn't pass, which is that he'll just let Obamacare fail and blame Democrats for its failure. On the other hand, when I look at all those obstacles to the bill passing, I also have a lot of trouble seeing how they can fail to pass anything, which is to say that if Republicans don't deliver on the core promise they've been making for 7 years to repeal and replace Obamacare, then what do they have to offer their base? It seems like a failure would cause the GOP to collapse into sniping and infighting and destroy whatever enthusiasm they've built for Trump with their base. So I guess, Rich, looking at that sort of the irresistible force encountering the immovable yep. object, which of these two outcomes is the less unthinkable outcome?
I think it's still likelier than not that it passes the House and probably ultimately gets signed into law. I'm not certain of that by any means, but in my readout from that meeting with the conservative dissidents that Trump had, he's pretty committed to this thing. And as we discussed a week or two ago, I think the logic of his presidency means he has to be committed to this thing. Because if it goes down, it means they might be looking at a complete year of failure in Congress, and it'll be enormous black eye for him. And it's true that conservatives in the House can defy Paul Ryan. They've defied their speakers before. But defying Donald Trump will be something different if he really wants to go after them. And I thought his tweet this week where he said, my good, wonderful, beautiful friend Rand Paul is going to be so happy, I know, ultimately to endorse our wonderful, beautiful Obamacare replacement. There's an implied threat in that. And the threat is, you know what, Rand, you actually might end up with a nickname if you're not careful, and it's going to be very uncomfortable for you. And so I think ultimately the kind of this will it'll pass just on sheer, if it does, on sheer partisan muscle. And on the belief that they have to produce something after saying we're going to do this for so long, and the alternative, which will be a political debacle on various levels, will be a key motivating factor as well.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I look at that, and that obviously was a veiled threat to Rand, not a very not a very veiled threat to
but
Rand
then
Paul.
He didn't do it. Well, he didn't go. I mean, he made plans to go visit Kentucky, and then he didn't go. So,
well, but the other thing is, Rand Paul was just reelected.
Right.
When he was initially elected 6 years ago, he beat the establishment figure that had all the establishment backing in the Republican Party. For all Rand Paul knows, next time he faces an electorate in 2022, Donald Trump won't even be president anymore. So I just there's a lot that the president can do to scare people in the Republican conference, but he can only lose two senators in the Senate. He can only lose 19 members in the House. So if you have, you know, only a handful of people like Rand Paul who are like, actually, I'm politically insulated. I don't need to listen to Donald Trump on this. I think that's where the bill can fail.
Yeah, I agree. And, Paul Ryan, before him, John Boehner, has in the past had to rely on, on tough votes on Democrats, and he's not going to get one. So that puts the House a little bit up in the air, although I expect it to pass the House too. I'm with Josh on this. I think he either loses folks on the right, like Rand Paul and Ted Cruz, although I guess they had nice family dinner, which I would have loved to be there to see Heidi Cruz having dinner with Donald Trump. But anyway, I digress. Or he's going to lose, Susan Collins or Tom Cotton. I mean, he's got very little range at this point, even using reconciliation.
The other interesting phenomenon about some of this opposition, Tom Cotton, senator from Arkansas, was very critical of the bill this week in the process, said, why don't we take our time? Cotton, like Paul, represents a poor state that has an unusually large number of people who benefit from the health care law. And there's sort of a strategy you can pursue as a Republican in those states where you can like stand up and loudly protest that the bill is not conservative enough. And if that allows you to defeat the bill, then both the people on Medicaid in your state and the hospitals that depend on the payments from that, they get the benefit of keeping them. You can protect Obamacare without ever saying out loud that that's what you're doing. Megan, when you look at this, I mean, you obviously talked about the very big political hazards that come from passing this bill. Do you think that's uglier than failing to pass anything from the perspective of Republicans?
Yes, I do. So I think when I look at how this goes forward, I'm somewhat less sanguine. I tend to think it's going to pass the House, but not sure. I tend to think it's going to die in the Senate, and for a couple of reasons. As you say, there are Republicans from Medicaid expansion states. Some of them are on the right. Some of them are towards the left wing of the party. Corralling them all together is going to be very difficult, and they don't have room to lose them. And that's before we've got a CBO score. The AARP hates this. And so the parallel I look at is Social Security reform, right? This was Bush campaigned on this. This was going to be his signature second term issue. And Republicans have been wanting to do this for decades. And totally died. Why? Because once people started, the score came out and the headlines hit, people started defecting. And it wasn't even that they did or didn't want to do it, right? It was that they were too afraid of their voters. And I tend to think that that is what's going to happen again. Rand Paul is not going to be nearly as afraid of Trump as he is going to be afraid of a pretty old state where people are going to come for his head if he allows them to switch. It's, one of the things this bill does is do age rating, so you can charge old people five times as much as the youngest people. And so I think, look, if there's a miracle and they somehow manage to push it through the Senate, I don't see how, but it could be negotiated. There'd be lots of changes, right? Then I think that you've got two issues. And the first is that I am really skeptical. Maybe this $100 billion they're pushing into the markets will stabilize the individual market enough that it doesn't collapse. But you're taking Medicaid away from people, and those people are going to be unhappy, and some of them do vote Republican in red states. You are then also, there is a very good chance the individual market does fail, and you own that. And that's got to be worse for the Republicans than standing around and saying, yes, we didn't repeal Obamacare because Democrats wouldn't let us. We took it up to the Senate. They filibustered. We did our best. They just were, these guys pushed a terrible garbage program, and then their terrible garbage program failed, and they wouldn't even let us fix it. I think that's got to be a better political message for them than, we did this thing, and now you can't buy health insurance. Sorry, guys, but it's awesome, right? Because we repealed Obamacare.
But it's not a great one, Megan, because basically
you're
saying—
They don't have good options, though.
I know,
right?
I know.
What are their good options? So
right,
that's the best.
But then you're coming back and you're saying, we control all three branches, and, we control the House, the Senate, and the White House, and we failed to enact our signature accomplishment. And
sure,
now I think you own Obamacare. It becomes Trump care anyway.
Because I think that is wishful thinking on the part of the left. In the same way that Obama blamed Bush for the financial crisis and everything that happened in the economy for years, I think the Democrats are going to own part of this. And I've heard this from other people. And I really think this is kind of like, wait, no, no, Democrats are going to own a lot of it if the exchanges go down, unless Republicans touch it, at which point Republicans own it.
Where does Mitch McConnell come down on this question between you two?
Yeah.
that ultimately will have a big influence on what happens. But the path to passage, and I don't discount what any of you are saying, and there's a very good chance you might be right, but you move it to the right on Medicaid in the House, you pass it out of the House, then you move it to the left on the size of the credits and on Medicaid, maybe other things in the Senate, you win over the moderates, and then you rely on Trump to kind of work the conservatives who might be more susceptible to his pressure in the Senate, and then you'd send it back to the House and you say, look, this is even worse than the bill you didn't like initially, but this is your chance, and you've promised forever you would do this, and then you hold the vote open for 3 hours, you break some arms on the floor, and you pass it by a vote. That's how it'll pass.
So you think it's the path to passage involves giving the moderates and the party what they want and then ultimately jamming the conservatives and telling them this is the best deal they can get?
I think in the Senate, the moderates will have more substantive leverage than the conservatives.
We've reached that time once again for our famed Left, Right, and Center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Joan Walsh, what's on your mind?
I woke up Friday to blaring headlines, especially a big red bulletin at the top of CNN, saying that in the second month of his presidency, Donald Trump saw a rise, a decline in unemployment, and an addition of 235,000 jobs. And I just wanted to say, stop. It is way too early to be giving the president any kind of even implied credit for a drop in unemployment. Let's take a few months and see what happens.
Meghan McArdle.
Samantha Bee had to apologize when she made a joke about Nazi hair at CPAC, and it turned out that one of the people she joked about was in recovery for stage 4 brain cancer. Then she apologized for having offended him. I would like to see a moratorium on calling people Nazis who are not actual Nazis, and also, more broadly, treating people on the other side of the political spectrum as human beings. And when you screw up, as Samantha Bee did, not apologizing for offending them, but apologize for having done something you really shouldn't have done.
Rich Lowry.
High standard there, Megan. Very high standard. We've been used to free speech outrages on campus the last few years, but even so, what happened at Middlebury College last week was truly remarkable. Not only was the conservative scholar Charles Murray shut down and chased from campus, but the liberal professor who was his designated interlocutor in order to provide some intellectual balance to his presentation, was attacked, briefly had to go to the hospital, and said she feared for her life. So we're on a trajectory where an element of the left is out to make some campuses literally an unsafe space for any dissent.
For my rant, right after Donald Trump was elected, we saw this big shift in economic sentiment measures, consumer confidence, business confidence, and the shift was all Republicans. Republicans who owned businesses or who were consumers who didn't like Obama and what he was doing with the economy suddenly felt very confident under President Trump. Now, these soft measures of sentiment don't always translate into the hard data, things like retail sales, housing starts, and the jobs report. But it's interesting to me looking at this jobs report we got this week, 235,000 new jobs. It's not a great report. It is a good report. Over 2015 and 2016, 12 out of 24 times we created more jobs than this. That said, it's a pretty strong number. And if it picks up over the next few months, we should consider sometimes those sentiment things can just become a self-fulfilling prophecy. If business owners feel more confident, they may hire more people and create more jobs. And so we should, as we watch the data, if it continues to improve over the next few months, we should consider the possibility that Donald Trump may improve the economy simply by his existence, because there are people out there who feel more inclined to spend and hire because he is president. It may not be fair, but it may be true. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Rich Lowry, Joan Walsh, and Meghan McArdle. Laura Dine-Million produced today's program. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Katie Burskins is our production assistant. I'm Josh Barrow. Thank you for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes and share your comments at kcrw.com/LRC. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.